Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 90. I'm recording it on Monday, February 2nd, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod. I took it from his website at incompetech.com. And the title of this selection is Dirt Roads, R-H-O-D-E-S. The title of the podcast is Irrational Exuberance Explains It All. A lot of people, the number of articles you see talking about our economic crisis is, there are probably over 100 posted every day on the internet. The number is probably in the hundreds, several hundreds. I try to read a certain number of them, but there's no way to keep up. And there are people planning on writing books. The one I'm most looking forward to is the one by Michael Lewis. He's writing a book on the financial crisis. He's the author of Liar's Poker. He tends to take a more journalistic approach to these questions rather than an investing expert, so to speak, take on questions, and that's the approach I take. I take a journalistic approach. I think a journalistic approach has a huge advantage. A lot of people have come to believe in investing experts, and I don't think such a thing exists today. I think our knowledge of investing is far too primitive for anyone to properly be referred to as an expert today. But the journalistic approach has a big advantage in that, at least if it's done right, because the idea of journalism is that you're supposed to dig and you're supposed to look for controversy. You're supposed to look for differences of opinion. You're supposed to look for balance. And if you do that, what you find, this is what I found in the last 7 years. I didn't start out thinking I was going to find this. I fell into these questions by accident. But what I found is that when you go on the internet looking for reasons to question the conventional investing wisdom of today, the passive investing model, there's tons of stuff out there. There's academic research showing that the passive investing model does not make sense, that goes back almost 30 years. There are books, there are websites, there are calculators, just all kinds of things. And you wouldn't know it. You ask one of the experts, is it really safe to leave all your retirement money in stocks at times of insanely dangerous prices? And they say, oh yes, oh very safe, very safe. It's been studied. There are studies. It's safe. The prudent thing to do. Oh, lowering your allocation, that would be dangerous. Don't do anything dangerous. Be careful. But I've come to believe that the stock selling industry has a certain bias. They to a large extent, they all stick together. They all stick together, and they all sort of stick together in defense of this passive investing, efficient market theory idea. And they don't want to question it. It's not that there aren't people out there questioning it. There are lots of people questioning it, and questioning it very effectively. But the people who we've put in the position of expert have reasons for not wanting to question it. And I don't think they're bad people, but I think they're compromised. I think it's very hard to speak out against your friends. You know, this is one of the things we can learn. This is one of the reasons why I believe in going to discussion boards to learn about how investing works in the real world. Because what you'll see on discussion boards is you see how humans interact. And humans do not like to speak out against their friends. Now, Now, that's not altogether a bad trait. There's a certain virtue called loyalty. But loyalty is not the way to achieve the best investing results. Loyalty to people. I mean, you obviously should be loyal to your friends, but when you discover that an investing idea has failed, it needs to be changed, whether that hurts your friends' feelings or not. In the long term, I would think it would hurt your friend more to continue following a bad idea than it would whatever temporary hurt he would feel in learning that he got something wrong. But we see on investing discussion boards without any question that people don't like to speak out against their friends. And all of the people that advocate passive investing are, to a large extent, they're a big clique. It's a big club. A club of smart and good people who made a mistake and who very much don't want to think that they made such a huge mistake. It's the greatest mistake, the mistake that has caused the most human misery. No other mistake in personal finance history has caused this much human misery. Terrible, terrible, terrible mistake. And of course, the longer it goes on, the more pain it causes. But the point of this podcast is to argue that we don't need to go around looking for the reasons for this economic catastrophe we've suffered. The reason is staring us in the face. There's a what's that thing called? Is it Occam's razor that says, you know, don't go searching for complicated explanations. The most simple explanation, the most obvious explanation is usually the true one. It's not hard to figure out what happened here. Read Irrational Exuberance. Don't wait. You know, read Michael Lewis's book when it comes out. I'm going to. And I'm sure there are going to be other good books coming out. I'm going to have a book coming out someday. God knows when. But someday. I hope you read that one. But you don't have to wait for those books to figure out what happened. Read Irrational Exuberance. It's in the library. It's at Amazon.com. It's in paperback. You can get used copies. Read it. I think it would be fair to say that Robert Shiller has a whole big bunch more credibility than any of these other characters who are coming on the scene now after stock prices fell and saying, maybe we need changes in the banking regulations. Maybe it was a bad idea to recommend that people invest in the S&P. They should be in the Global Fund, or they should be in the Wellesley Fund or the Windsor Fund. Passive investing may not always work, but I have a plan B. I have a plan B. That's Taylor Larimore. I have a plan B. I've never told you about it before. Plan B is to get out of stocks after prices crash. Get out 100%. Plan B. I never mentioned it before. I didn't think anybody would be interested. It's just my own personal little plan B. Heaven help us all. No dig intended to Taylor. I'm sorry for his losses. Still. We don't have to go searching. And so the point of this podcast is the answer staring us in the face. That's a wonderful news, because what it means is that we don't have to, you know, if we think the job is creating some sort of economic stimulus, or if we think the job is, you know, bank regulations or housing regulations or whatever it is we come up with. If we think that's the job, we've got a lot of work ahead of us. You know, who knows how to draft the perfect banking regulations and all this whatnot. But the intellectual work needed to solve our economic problems. That work, people started doing that work in 1981. We've got 30 years of intellectual work done. It's all done. I mean, we don't know the answers to every question, but we sure know a whole lot more than any more than a tiny number of middle-class investors have ever heard. What if we just start talking about what we already know, what we've been learning for 30 years now, all the stuff I've been digging up over 7 years of journalistic work on the subject of how stock investing works in the real world? What if we tell people about it? What if we open up Motley Fool to honest posting on stock investing? What if we open up Morningstar? What if we open up Bogleheads.org? What if we open up IndexUniverse.com? We could spend 5 years discussing all of the material that's been developed over the past 30 years and that has been kept secret from the American public. And responding to it, you know, releasing it, getting the experts to comment on it, you know, fine-tuning it, developing calculators, the sort of tools that John Russell and I have developed. We could have a ball. And we'd know a whole lot more about stock investing than we know today at the end of that 5 years. And I'll bet you confidence in the stock market would be a lot higher than it is today. I bet you we can hold off on that 50% price drop that's going to come if we don't restore confidence. So this podcast is it's a plea to stop, you know, stop the fooling around. This ain't no disco, no CBGBs. This ain't no fooling around. We're headed over a cliff. We're headed into a depression. I was talking to my brother last week. I might have reported this on an earlier podcast. I was talking to my brother on the telephone, my younger brother, and you know, he said, "Well, what's up? You know, what's going on?" I said, "Well, same old, you know, just trying to save the world from passive investing, trying to rewrite the model we use to understand how stock investing works in the real world." He says, "Oh yeah. Yeah, I've been busy too, you know, I've been busy too." And I said, "Steve, I really wish you had called me, you know, my brother lost some money in the stock market, like so many others. And I said, I really wish you had called me to talk about that. You know, what are brothers for? Here I am, you know, I've spent 7 years of my life on this and you didn't call?" And he says, "Well," he says, "I looked at your calculator, you know," he says, "it said 2%. I think he said it said 2% at the time he looked, 2% return on stocks. He says, "I didn't think that was too bad." Oh, God. Heaven help us all. It probably did say 2%, but I said, "Well, Steve, you know, you're supposed to get a risk premium of at least 2% a year for taking the risk of stocks." I said, if all you're getting is 2%, that's equivalent to 0% on something safer. But anyway, you know, the thought that hits me is how upset can I get with the goons? I don't at all approve the behavior of the goons who have destroyed so many of our discussion boards. But how upset can you get with them when your own brother won't call you for advice? You know, it's like we're under a spell. I think we're under a spell. There's something that just stops us from wanting to know the truth about stock investing. I really believe this, you know. Of course, I'm reading Lord of the Rings, you know, to my boys, and there's that section where I forget the king's name, all the names, you know. Too many names in that book, but there's some king, and he's supposed to be one of the good guys, but he's under a spell. And then they get the spell lifted. I guess Gandalf lifts the spell, you know, the king sends his army out, and they defeat Saruman. But that's how I feel. It's like there's all these good people, and they're under a spell. They act like they want to know. They're directing huge amounts of human energy to it. This is what I mean. I see these hundreds of articles Huge amount. I just think sometimes, what if we took that, right now, let's say that there's huge amounts of human industry being devoted to understanding how stock investing works. But 90% of it, I think it would be fair to say, is devoted to blocking out the realities, rationalizing. 90% is spent coming up with stories so that we don't have to accept the obvious truth. That valuations affect long-term returns. What if that 90% of our human industries were turned to positive purposes? What if we started using it in constructive ways? Can you imagine what we could do? You know, I'm going to tell the... I think I told this story in a recent podcast. I'm not 100% sure. But if I didn't tell it, I'll tell it again, maybe briefly. But it strikes me as so human. It tells the story so well, if just it clicks with you. But I remember those days when I used to live in my apartment on Q Street, 18th and Q. I used to live in Imperial House back in the District of Columbia, for many years, before I was married. And, you know, the day would come, April 15th, when you had to file your taxes. And, you know, I'm a natural-born procrastinator. And, you know, I'd put it off and either... You know, sometimes it would either be the Sunday before I'd be freaking out or the day of the tax, whatever it would be. But, you know, I'd set a deadline for myself, got to get this return in. And it would just always crack me up because, say it was a Sunday, you know, and I'd get up early. I'd get up at 6 in the morning to do the taxes. And, you know, I said, oh, I'm just going to read the paper. Then I'm going to settle down and do this taxes. And then when the paper, you know, I'm done the paper, I'd say, well, you know, I don't want to start. You know, and get all the papers out and then get hungry. So I should go out and get some breakfast, you know. But then I'm going to do those taxes. I'd go out and have some breakfast, you know. I'd be walking down the street, you know, after breakfast, and I'd see somebody that, you know, I'd see somebody ordinarily I wouldn't really want to talk to that much. I'd say, hey, old friend, you know. I'd try to get into a conversation. You know, and then I'd be looking in all the windows. You know, all kinds of things I never looked at before. I never noticed this store, jewelry store, very interesting. I might want to get married someday. I should look at the rings. You know, I wonder what kind of rings they have. I wish they were open. Well, they're going to open in half an hour. Maybe if I just wait it, I could walk around the block a few times, you know. Then there'd be a hardware store, and I'd say, oh, look at all the interesting stuff. How come I never noticed this before? And I'd be walking down the aisles of the hardware store. Look at all these nails, all these kinds of, oh, you know. And then I'd get home and I'd get out the tax form. By now it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, you know. And I'd get out the tax forms and, you know, I better read all the instructions. I don't want to make any mistakes. I better start at page one, you know. Then I'd start filling it out. I'd put in my name. That'd be fine. You know, name, social security number. I can handle that. And then there'd be the part where you have to do a calculation, you know, to get your AGI, you know. And I'd say, I almost forgot. I got to get my laundry done, you know. And I'd go down there and I'd start the laundry. And there'd be some girl down there doing her laundry. And I'd say, boy, good day for laundry. Good day for laundry, huh? And I'd start cleaning the apartment, this apartment. And you know, and then about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it would hit me. Oh, I've been thinking about, I've got to get an oil change in my car. I can't go another day. I've got to go do that. And I'd get the oil change. And, you know, I'd come back and I'd say, oh, a little music in the background would be good while I'm doing this AGI calculation. And then I'd say, hey, I haven't, my records, they're not organized. These are not alphabetically organized. I don't know where to find anything. I've got to organize my record collection before I do anything else. You know, and 1 o'clock in the morning, I would finish the darn tax thing. But it was a great way to get all your chores done. It's a great way to get all your chores. Your bills, the bills would be paid by the end of the day. my shirts would all be in order. The, you know, the 3A crew, and then the 3 blue, and then the three, what is it? There's a check pattern that I like, but I can't think of the name of it. You know, whatever. They'd be in order. You know, the golf shirts would be after them. You know, they'd all be, everything would be in order for the new work week. Well, that's what we're going through now. We're all playing mental games. We're saying, oh, let's pass a stimulus bill. Oh, let's go after the bad banking people. Oh, did you hear about Bernie Madoff? Bad man. Very, very bad man. Oh, maybe capitalism doesn't work. And it goes on and on and on and on. But we're all trying to avoid the obvious reality that's been staring in our face, depending on how closely you follow this. If you follow the literature, like the experts are supposed to, you've known about this since 1981. That's when Shiller came out with his first research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. If valuations affect long-term returns, passive investing can't work, can it? If valuations affect long-term returns, the value proposition of stocks changes when the price changes. So you don't want to be at the same stock allocation at all times. If you don't follow it quite so closely, then you've known this since 1980, when Shiller published Irrational Exuberance. So if you want to know what's going on, I mean, I hope you'll listen to my podcast and read the articles at my site and work the calculators at my site. That would make me happy. But if you don't want to put your trust in some guy who posts stuff on the internet, which kind of sort of makes sense, I can see that. If you don't want to do that, read Irrational Exuberance. Because when you read Irrational Exuberance, you're not reading some guy who said, oh, I'm going to make a buck out of this crisis. There's been a crisis, so now I'll write a book telling people what happened. You're reading a book by a guy who saw it coming. Doesn't that give the guy some credibility? And please, please, don't get into this stuff of thinking, oh, maybe stocks were a little overvalued, but that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It wasn't. Read the book. Here's what he says. Page 213. Robert Shiller, Irrational Exuberance. If over some interval in the first decade or so of the 21st century, the U.S. stock market is going to follow an uneven course down, as well it might, back, let us say, to the levels in the mid-90s or even lower, then individuals, foundations, college endowments, and other beneficiaries of the market are going to find themselves poorer in the aggregate by trillions of dollars. The real losses could be comparable to the total destruction of all the schools in the country, or all the farms in the country, or possibly even all the homes in the country. Do you still need another explanation for what's happened? Other than the fact that we started thinking that maybe valuations don't matter? I've done a back of the envelope calculation on how much that mistake cost us. We're now at fair value. We lost $8 trillion in the past 15 months or so. That means we were overvalued by $8 trillion. We also lost $4 trillion in the housing bubble, which was caused by the stock bubble, the funny money that we created by creating a stock bubble just moved on over into the housing bubble. So that's another $4 trillion. So 8 plus 4 is 12. We lost $4 trillion from 1980 to 2008. When stocks were falling at a much more gradual pace. So add 8 and 4 and 4 and you got 16. $16 trillion. Very rough number. But $16 trillion is a very rough number for how much we pumped up stock prices, how much we pretended to have that we didn't have. So now 16 trillion has been taken out. And it's and there are people surprised that we've experienced an economic crisis. If anyone who is surprised is not an investing expert. Now, you know, they took all the courses. If the question is, did they take a lot of courses? Did they pass a lot of tests? Well, sure. But is that what it means to be an expert? I would say you can't be an expert unless you know the ABCs of the subject. And if you don't understand that taking $16 trillion out of the stock market is going to cause an economic crisis, you don't understand the ABCs. You're clueless. John Bogle is clueless about how stock investing works. Yes, he's a genius. Yes, he's a hero of mine. Yes, he's an expert. But he's also clueless. All of these things are so, and they need to be said. And you see, admitting that John Bogle is clueless means admitting that we're clueless, because if, you know, we all believe in John Bogle, and if John Bogle's clueless, then we're clueless. And that's why we're doing silly things like, you know, organizing our record collection and getting the oil changed and walking down the aisles of the hardware store. We don't want to admit that we're clueless. We don't want to admit that John Bogle is clueless. We're ashamed. We're ashamed that we did this to ourselves. If I could, I'd reach through the computer screen and give everybody a big hug and say it'll be okay. But I do think we have to get over our shame before we go over the cliff. I think that would be a good idea. Shiller expected it. And of course, lots of others expected it. It wasn't only Shiller. I talked about that guy, Michael Alexander, the author of the book Stock Cycles. He expected it. He wrote as the subtitle of his book, Why Money Markets Are Going to Beat Stocks for the Next 20 Years. Is that not a bold claim? How did Michael Alexander get to be so darn smart? He looked at how stocks work. That's all. He just did the same thing I did. He figured out that passive investing makes zero sense. And then he went around the internet and looked for people who knew what they were talking about. And then once he knew how it worked, he said, well, looks like money markets are going to beat stocks. So he told us so. And there's lots of people who have done that. And these are the people who are, whether they're experts or not, you can argue. They're more expert than the people who believe in passive investing. But, you know, I make the argument that no one's a true expert, because until we get everybody working together, we can't really develop this knowledge fully. So we're all held back, passives and rationals both. The shocking thing is, Shiller put out this book in March of 2000. It was a bestseller. It was widely praised. Why didn't anybody read it? Is that a rude question? You know, it was getting these 5-star reviews in Business Week and Fortune and Forbes, you know. It would have been nice if somebody had read it. Maybe they read it. Maybe they just forgot. Maybe they forgot what it said. Well, Monday morning came, you know, to write their article in the stock market. They forgot. What do you think happened? They can't let it in. They can't let it in. You can't believe what Robert Shiller says and also believe what John Bogle says. You can't believe in rational investing and also believe in passive investing. They're two opposite models. You can't believe that valuations affect long-term returns, that valuations are the single most important thing you need to know about to invest effectively, and also believe that valuations have zero effect and that sticking at the same stock allocation is okay. You can't believe both of those things. I can't tell you how many times I had people at Motley Fool, they'd say to me, Rob, you know, we love you, man. Great stuff on the savings side. Our favorite poster, we love you, but Rob, could you stop talking about the errors and the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, please? And I, you know, look, I think I offered a fair deal. I said one time at Motley Fool, I said, if everyone's willing to agree not to recommend these studies anymore, I will never discuss it again. I am willing to go along with that. I said, I don't recommend it. I think we need to talk about it. But if other people feel too upset, I am willing to just drop it. But it would be dishonest if someone's going to come on the board, some newcomer, and say, you know, how should I plan my retirement? Someone's going to say, oh, here's one of these old school safe withdrawal rate studies. I know that the studies are analytically invalid. It would be dishonest of me not to say anything. I said, I'm willing not to start any threads. But if someone else brings the subject up, I have a moral obligation to at least let people know the other side of the story. But that didn't fly. Excuse me. What the passive investing dogmatists wanted was, we get to tell people about retirement studies that get the numbers wildly wrong, but no one can mention that they're wrong. That's the rule. That's the rule. Does that rule itself not tell you that we're on a bad track? A track so bad that it could explain everything that's gone wrong? Irrational exuberance explains it all. You see, and they would say, you know, I can remember there were some big threads, and I, you know, there'd be some big thread, and you know, the people, the abusive posters would put up something. I'd write a post, you know, answering somebody's question. They'd put up this post that would just be, you know, a line of Z's. You know, they're asleep. So they find it boring. They find the historical data boring. So boring that they've spent 7 years of their lives following me around the internet to block a discussion anywhere on the internet where this is talked about. That's how boring they find it. It doesn't add up. There's something not right there. They're in pain. It's not that they're bored, it's that they're in pain. They're trying to avoid something. They're defensive. Let me see here. You know, Schiller wrote an afterword. This is afterword to the paperback edition of his book. And he says, by some quirk of fate, the publication of the first edition of Irrational Exuberance corresponded quite closely to a record high. I love that part where he says, by some quirk of fate. I can't tell you how many times I've seen Schiller referenced in a magazine article or newspaper article, and people will say, Schiller predicted the tech crash. He did no such thing. It's like damning with faint praise. They're turning him into a fortune teller. You know, like he has a Ouija board. And his Ouija board told him the tech crash was going to come. And so he planned publication of his book at the time it came. He had no idea when the crash was coming. He knew for certain it was coming, because anybody who looked at the data knew for certain it was coming. Schiller is smarter than me or you. But you don't need to be smarter than me or you to look at the historical data. It's public information. Anyone can look at it. Anyone can do what Schiller did. Anyone. I made it easy to do by providing a calculator, the stock return predictor, but anyone could have done it. When there's 100 websites that have a stock return predictor of some sort, then you'll know that we're on our way to restoring confidence in the stock market. We've broken the taboo on honest discussion of the realities, and things are headed in the right direction. So long as there's only two websites, my site and John Walter Russell's site, that have a stock return predictor, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. That needs to change. You know, what's wonderful about reading this book after the crash is you get a totally different perspective. Before the crash, people dismissed it. You know, I say, why didn't they write about it? Well, what people did was they said, oh, you know, they did the same thing that they did on our boards. They'd make excuses. Oh, yeah, he's got some good points, but, well, it can't be that bad. Can't be that bad. It never can be that bad, except if you look at the numbers tell you it is that bad. But now you can read the book after the crash, and reading it after the crash, you can't tell yourself it might not be that bad. I mean, it is that bad, right? You know what's happened. The truth of the matter is, we haven't seen anything bad. Another pet peeve of mine. People will say, oh, a black swan event. How could we ever have known? We haven't had a bad price crash. Look at the historical data, and you will see. You know, there have been three times when we went to insane price levels. The average price drop on those three occasions was 68%. The current drop going back to January of 2000 is only 60%. So far, we're on the lucky side. And we've never had a case where we went as high as this time in valuations. The time that came closest to the current time, we had a drop of 80%. So, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet. So it's not been a black swan. It's all been what you would expect. It's all been somewhat less, somewhat softer than you would expect, given what we did to ourselves in the late 1990s, given that act of collective insanity that we committed when we allowed stocks to get to the prices we permitted them to get to in the late 1990s, when none of the experts were speaking up about it. When none of the experts were warning us about our foolhardy and dangerous and reckless behavior, putting our retirement money into an asset class that was likely to provide a long-term negative return. So Shiller, you know, he's talking here, you know, after about a year or two after he published the book, and he says, my recent surveys confirm that confidence remains as strong, almost as strong after the market drop. In other words, it didn't. If that market drop had caused people to reassess, we wouldn't have had to have. Well, we would have had to have another crash, but we could have done it in a more orderly way, and we could have done it with more grace, and we could have learned from the experience. But by putting your head in the sand and pretending there's not going to be another drop, you don't make it go away. All you do is you stretch out the pain. He says further weakness in the market, if it continues, should be expected to produce further declines in confidence, but probably only as years go by. You see, if we were rational, the market would fall in 1 year. It would all be done. But we only allow rationality in bits and pieces. So we've started to let rationality in January 2000, and we've been letting it in little by little, but we make a collective decision as to how much we can bear to hear. And you know, it's now 9 years and we still haven't let it all in. We still haven't corrected the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, but I like to think we're working our way up to it. This is Shiller. What the investing public is hearing from experts has not changed much. Those who lost their jobs for their pessimistic views are still not back in influential positions. You see, we doctor the record. We say we only want to hear that passive investing works. We don't want to hear that it doesn't work. So the people who speak out, you know, in discussion boards, they get banned. They get called trolls and they get removed from the boards. In real world, you know, they lose their jobs. And then we say, oh, none of the experts are saying that valuations affect long-term returns. None of the experts are saying that. Well, all the ones that still have jobs aren't saying it, but the ones who were telling the truth said it. They're just not around anymore. You fire them, yeah, they can't say it anymore, can they? They don't have a farm to speak from. When a theory is widely accepted as true, the theory can be reasserted in very oft-handed and even subtle ways. Ain't that the truth? The symmetrically opposite questions seem never to be asked. One never sees media accounts after an increase inquiring whether the market has, quote, found its top, or after a decrease, whether the market has, quote, begun a long-term decline. Here he is on page 240. Once, just before going on, he says, on several occasions, I have discovered firsthand the pressure on public prognosticators to deliver positive statements about the market. Once, just before going on national television, the anchor looked me squarely in the eye and told me what I said could conceivably have an impact on the market, and that people can get upset if they perceive prognosticators as disrupting the market. I mean, does that not tell you the story? That's like what Scott Burns told me. He says, Rob, the reason why, you told people the realities of safe withdrawal rates back in May of 2002. The reason why nobody's written this up in the mainstream media is it is information most people don't want to hear. In other words, we experts think of ourselves as being in the business of telling people what they want to hear. Well, guess what they want to hear when stocks are valued at 3x fair value? They want to hear that stocks are good for the long run. They want to hear buy and hold. Do you still want to hear buy and hold? If you still want to hear buy and hold, I'll bet you'll be able to find people telling you. If you still want to hear stocks for the long run, I bet you'll be able to find people telling you that. But if you want to achieve financial freedom early in life, if you want your retirement plan to survive, you need to stop encouraging people to tell you what you want to hear and ask them to please tell you what's true, what you need to hear. What did, you know, Dylan had a verse in Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. I don't know if I can recall it all. Who was it that came to see me? Somebody came to see me. Oh, boy. Someone came to see me. And she said, I know. I know about your debutante. But your debutante just knows what you need. I know what you want. And he says, oh, mama. Can this really be the end? Do you want it? You know, do you want what? Do you want? All right. Do you want to hear? Do you want people to tell you what you want to hear, or do you want people to tell you what you need to hear? You decide. You know, but Rob Bennett is universally known as a pain in the behind. Because Rob Bennett made a decision. There were enough community members who wanted to hear the truth that I said, I'm going to tell it. And I'm not going to be obnoxious about it. I won't start threads. I won't put up thread starters. I won't push it on people. But if people ask questions, I'm going to report what the historical data says. Not the fantasy world of passive investing. I'm going to report what it says. And I'm going to link to people like Shiller and S. Ness and Arnott and John Walter Russell and Ed Easterling and John Malden and Andrew Smithers and on and the ones who want to learn about it, it's there for them. And the ones who don't, there are tools on the internet to just skip by anything. You know, first of all, your eyeballs are a tool. Just skip by the post if you don't like it. And if your eyeballs don't work, a lot of boards have some kind of thing where you can, you know, click a button and you never see posts from that person again. So there's lots of ways around the mean historical data. That data is so mean. Oh, it's so mean. It tells you when stocks are not a good long-term value proposition. The historical data is so mean. Mom, do something. The historical data is being mean again. It's telling me passive investing won't work again, Mom. So I decided that I would be a pain in the butt to anybody who doesn't want to look at the historical data. I'd be kind. I'd be warm in my comments. I'd be polite. But I would cite the data. And you can like it or not like it. But my feeling is, if it makes your tummy hurt to read what the historical data says, it's from some guy who posted on the internet, it's going to hurt your tummy a whole lot more to see your portfolio statement devastated. So, you know, reality is mean. That's the way of saying it. Reality is mean. The job of some guy who posts on the internet is to brace people for reality. That's the job. You know, it's nice to be a puppy dog poster. I'm all for it. But, you know, the puppy dog's got a job to do. And if some guy's breaking in the house, some abusive poster's burning the house down, the puppy dog's got to wake up his master. He's got to bark like a mad dog until the master wakes up and gets his slippers on and his robe on and runs out of the house. That's the job. I'm a good puppy dog. Not a bad puppy dog, like people said. Some people said I was a bad puppy dog, but they're wrong. Schiller, I am in a different situation than that faced by the great majority of analysts who appear on these shows, most of whom would never say publicly that the market is highly overpriced. After all, these market analysts are often employed by firms such as investing management, brokerage, or underwriting companies with an interest in the market remaining high. But they're experts! They're not mean reporters who link to stuff on the internet. Oh, no. They're experts. With a capital E, they're experts. They help us. They help us. Nice experts. Nice experts. Gollum cracks me up. I'm reading Lord of the Rings to my boys, and Gollum's my favorite character. He says, oh, the nice hobbits. His Gollum helps the nice hobbits. Excuse me. I love his character. You know, one investment manager for pension plans spoke to me about how difficult it was for him to suggest in his public statements that people should perhaps be concerned about overpricing of the stock market. Despite his considerable reputation and apparent sympathy with the views expressed in my book, he seemed to be saying that it was not within his authority to make bold and unprovable statements contrary to conventional wisdom. An expert can't be questioning conventional wisdom. You're an expert. See, in every other field of endeavor, it's considered a good thing to question conventional wisdom on two bases. One, if the conventional wisdom is right, the conventional wisdom's going to survive. So the guy questioning it helps us all out. He makes us feel more confidence in the conventional wisdom. And on the other, if he finds a hole in the conventional wisdom, he advances our knowledge. But in stock investing, no. It's considered mean. To question the conventional wisdom at a time when the conventional wisdom is telling people to put their retirement money in the most reckless investment class imaginable. You know what Mel Lindauer used to say about me when I would post what the historical data says? He'd say, "Oh, Rob, we have to drive Rob off this board because he's dangerous. He's dangerous. It's dangerous for people to know the other side of the story. If people hear the other side of the story, they might not believe in passive investing anymore. That would be dangerous. Who would it be dangerous to, Mel? Who would be feeling this danger? Mel Lindauer would be feeling the danger. Because Mel Lindauer got some things wrong in his book. Unintentionally, but wrong all the same. So he views it as dangerous. If someone talks about the realities on a discussion board, dangerous. It's dangerous to consider to report accurate numbers for a retirement study. It's dangerous. These two models are completely incompatible. This is the basic reality. And we have to make a choice. We're going to have to make a choice. And the choice is, we can continue on the path we're on, recommending passive investing, even though it's never worked in history. It's been tried 4 times. First time, it brought bone-crushing losses to all who tried it. Second time, it brought bone-crushing losses to all who tried it. Third time, it brought, let me look, oh yeah, bone-crushing losses to all who followed it. And the fourth time, surprise, surprise, bone-crushing losses to all who followed it. So we could continue on that path. We could continue. Or we can acknowledge we made a mistake. We can go back. Or at the very minimum, we could acknowledge that we're not sure. Because if we're not sure, that would at least open the door to discussion. So we could determine whether we made a mistake or not. But those are the choices. There, you know, again, Dylan had a line, and this was during his sort of dogmatic period. They call it his religious period, but unfortunately, it was a sort of a dogmatic religious period. Sort of ruined it in my eyes. But he said, you either got faith or you got unbelief, and there ain't no neutral ground. Well, I'm not in favor of dogmatism as a rule, but when it comes to the question of whether valuations affect long-term returns, you either believe it or you don't, and there ain't no neutral ground. You're either a passive investor or you're a rational investor. Most investors try to split it down the middle. Most investors are not dogmatic passive investors. That's a small number. But the trouble is, the dogmatics are scared to death to allow discussion of the realities, to allow discussion of what the historical data says. And the people in the middle generally don't want to see trouble. And so the people in the middle just say, well, you know, they don't really believe the dogmatics, but they say, why are these other people causing trouble? You know, everybody agrees that passive investing's okay. Well, everyone doesn't agree. There have been people saying passive investing doesn't work for close to 30 years now. Everyone doesn't agree. And if we allow discussions, you can decide for yourself. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of possibilities in terms of, you know, what's reasonable. But what is totally unreasonable is the idea that valuations have zero effect. And that's what passive investing says. Passive investing says there's not a need to change your allocation at all. That's totally unreasonable. The debate should be how much should you change it. There's no debate as to whether you need to change it. No reasonable debate. And that's why I say irrational exuberance explains it all. If you just think about how insane the path that we are on is, how insane it is to think that there's... See, what happens is once you go down the path of saying passive investing works, you don't look at valuations. So somebody like John Bogle, he's Mr. Passive Investing. So I use him as my usual example. He doesn't know how bad it is. He doesn't look at valuations. He stopped looking at them. So Bogle was asked about valuations at one of these annual meetings of the diehards, and he used PE1. You're not going to use PE1 if you understand how valuations work. Nobody who is serious about valuations uses PE1. You know, I use PE10. Some people use Tobin's Q. You know, some people use the Gordon equation. But I don't know of anybody who's serious about valuations who uses PE1. So Bogle's not even in the game. You know, he's never bothered to look. He doesn't have a clue. But that's who people are turning to for the question, you know, do valuations matter? And he says, oh, I don't think they matter too much. How would you know? How would you know if you don't even use a valid valuation assessment tool? How would you possibly know how bad they are? All the people who knew how bad it was. I remember Ben Solar, and Ben Solar is the most unbiased guy against me there could be. Ben Solar stuck up for me on many occasions. And Ben Solar, you know, when we reported the safe withdrawal rate is 2%, his eyes were popping out. He was saying, look, Rob, he says, I've spoken out against Graney. I've spoken out against the abuse of posting, the campaign of terror. I think you should be allowed to speak. You've added a lot, but it can't have been 2%. It just can't have been. And I say, Ben, why not? Why can't it have been 2%? That's what the numbers say. But he couldn't believe it. He just, It was like a shock to his system. That's because the way human beings work is we come to accept what's in the environment. We come to accept what we've heard. And so long as discussion of the historical data is banned and prohibited, we're not going to hear the realities. And so once you accept the passive investing might be okay, it's like you're drifting out into the ocean and you just keep drifting farther and farther and farther. And one time you look up and you're so far from land, you can't even see it. And you're like, how did I get out here? There's sharks out here. How did I get out here? You got out there by not paying any attention to what was going on. We didn't become passive investors in a day or a week or a month. Bogle started Vanguard in the late 1970s. Valuations didn't become insane until 1995. It took almost 20 years. But once you get there, it's pretty hard to get back. Once you get there to where you've destroyed, you know, millions of middle-class lives, it's pretty hard to admit that you made that mistake. The way to stop passive investing is to never adopt it in the first place. But it's too late for that now. It's too late for that now. We've got to figure out a way to work together to get back to sanity. And the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices change dramatically is insane. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me why I'm wrong. No one's ever done it in 7 years. If the entire idea of passive investing is insane, does that not suggest this problem is big enough to be the sole explanation of our economic troubles today? You know, John Walter Russell, he did an article at his site looking at, you know, people look at what happened in the 1920s and they say, oh, that's the worst we've ever seen. We were so unlucky. We weren't unlucky. He looked at the return sequence, and you know what he found? The return sequence in the 1920s, 1930s, was a slightly lucky return sequence. It wasn't unlucky at all. It was slightly on the lucky side. It wasn't very lucky, but it was, you know, on the if you had a range, if you had a continuum of possibilities, it was about, you know, I don't know, it was about a 55% number. It was luckier than it was unlucky, slightly lucky. People don't know that. People think it was unlucky. What they're not considering is the valuation level was so horribly, catastrophically bad that even with a lucky return sequence, we had an 80% drop. Well, what do you think we're going to have this time? Our P10 level went far higher this time than in 1929. So far, we've been very lucky. But most people don't think it. If you ask people, have we been lucky in the returns we've gotten from stocks in recent years, they'd say, oh no, horribly unlucky. But it's just not true. It's just not true. We've been incredibly lucky so far. We better hope that our luck holds out. But there's no guarantee it will. And we need to be prepared. And we need to be telling people what the probabilities are for various outcomes so that they're prepared, so that they know what's coming. And in order to do that, we've got to stop the passive investing nonsense, because you can't have a conversation until you're talking the same language. And if there are people, you know, people pretending that you don't need to change your stock allocation, that's like pretending the world is flat. You can't have a discussion on those terms. We can't agree on the most basic things. Things that, there is nothing more basic than the fact that valuations affect long-term returns. That's the ABCs. So, you know, we've got to get past the ABCs. We've got to get the ABCs right. I always remember this guy, Artie, and he was a great poster at the Financial Freedom blog, and Artie was not at all biased against me. He's a big supporter. But he wrote one time, and this wasn't that long ago. It was before the crash. And he said, Rob, drop all this discussion board stuff. That's all a big waste of time. He said, what you need is a peer-reviewed study, you know, showing that valuations affect long-term returns. And I'm saying, Artie, we don't need any such thing. We've got 30 years of them. People have been doing this for years and years and years, decades now. It's not a lack of research that's the problem. It's that people won't look at it, and they won't take it. When they do look at it, they won't take it serious. When they look at it, they say, oh, that's nice. And they go right back. Like I said, they read Irrational Exuberance, and they go right back to recommending passive investing on Monday morning. They don't let it affect them. They don't let it change their behavior. The purpose of learning is to change your behavior. So when you've got an emotional brick wall this big, that brick wall is capable of causing the catastrophe we've experienced. Irrational exuberance explains it all. Here's Schiller talking about the reaction to his book. He says, in looking over the 100-odd reviews and stories that this book has received in newspapers and magazines in the United States and around the world, I find that there is remarkably little serious or pointed criticism. Most of the reviews have been quite supportive. If there is any single most important theme to the criticism my book has received, it isn't about technical details, like the construction of the price-earnings ratio. Rather, it is that I did not prove that there is not, in fact, a technological revolution that will permanently boost the market. That's consistent with the reaction I've seen. I've had lots and lots of people respond very positively to the stuff I've said. But they don't, you know, what Schiller's saying there is they don't take what he's saying seriously. They make excuses. They say, well, yeah, you know, good points, but maybe it'll be different this time. Maybe somehow it'll all work out. And that's sort of the reaction. That's the reaction I get from most people. You know, the dogmatics obviously are intense and abusive. But they're not the average person. But the average people respond with sort of an indifference. And indifference hurts us. The way to learn is when you find something wrong in your thinking, drill down. Don't let that pass your attention. Focus on it until you fixed it. Until you've resolved the contradiction. Resolve all contradictions if you can. And that's not what we've done in the years since Irrational Exuberance has been published. What we've done is this man published this wonderful book. It got great reviews. He's backed it up by research. Lots, you know, dozens of other people have backed it up with work they've done. And it's ignored. It's ignored by the quote-unquote experts. It's ignored by the people who advocate passive investing. And it's not some little challenge to passive investing on some fine point. It's a dagger thrust at the heart of the passive investing model. If Schiller is right, Bogle is wrong. Not about everything. Bogle's right, of course, about many, many things. But he's wrong about the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insane levels. He's wrong. And, you know, that's the next step in our understanding of how stock investing works. Once that's established and accepted, and there's a consensus, then everything's fine. You know, we're not going to get the money back we lost. We lost it because it was never there in the first place. It was all phony. We just pretended. But if we learn how investing works, we don't have to have such bull markets again. They're optional. We can have, you know, leading policymakers come out and urge people not to let prices get so out of hand. And if prices never again get so out of hand, we're never again going to suffer the sorts of economic catastrophe we're dealing with today. But we do have to get serious. We have to stop talking about silly stuff. And we have to talk about the problem. The problem is passive investing. The problem is the idea that valuations don't matter. The problem is the idea that we don't need to change our stock allocations when prices get to insanely dangerous levels. That's what we need to be talking about. Irrational exuberance explains it all. That's the entire problem. For all we know, it's so big. Valuation is so big in effect. I mentioned earlier, $16 trillion. It's so big in effect, it masks everything else. It could be there's some problem with banking regulation, but how would you know until we fix the passive investing problem? You know, it's like there's a tornado going around and it's tearing your house to bits. And someone's saying, is that ashtray in the wrong place? You know, you can't even determine if there's a problem with the ashtray until you do something about the tornado. It dominates everything else. It could be that the banking industry is doing a better job than it's ever done before. But when you throw $16 trillion of funny money into the mix, you're going to get fraud. Of course. What would you expect? You know, humans are humans. There's going to be more fraud when you have more funny money floating around. So we need to focus on what the problem is. The problem is passive investing. That's Rob Bennett's message to the world. The problem is passive investing. We have to talk about the problem. And then we can deal with these other things as secondary issues. And it may be that there are some things that should be done. But we have to talk about the real problem. The real problem is the idea that we don't need to take valuations into account when setting our allocations. And that one is scary. It's as scary as the idea of Rob Bennett sitting down and doing his income tax, filling out his income tax form. We're doing everything but what we need to do, because the thing we need to do is scary as all get out. It means accepting that stock investing is not a rational endeavor. It's a highly emotional endeavor. And we're all scared to death to acknowledge that. We hate the thought that our retirement money is riding on emotions. We hate it. But the lesson that we should have learned is the passive investing model says, if you hate it, just ignore it and it'll go away. And that doesn't work. What we need to do is to come to terms with it. It's not quite so scary. Once you get it out on the table and you talk about it and you deal with it and you cope with it, it's still a little scary, but we can deal with it. You know, we're big boys and girls. We can cope, but we've got to be honest. Let me know if you have feedback. Click that contact Rob button at the left side of every page of the website, passionsaving.com. I'd love to hear from you. Good luck with your investing strategies.